You're listening to Raphael Epstein.
One of my favourite parts of the week with Josh Nelson. His film blog is phfilmology.com. Josh, welcome.
Good afternoon.
Now, we're going to be talking out of control, crazy characters. Off the back of, this is a documentary. We'll play the trailer in a moment, but I want you to tell me who these people are. This is a documentary about skaters.
It is. Two Australian brothers, Tuss and Ben Pappas, who seem to have been a little bit forgotten from the annals of skateboarding history, or the sporting heroes in this country, if you want to call them that, which they probably aren't, who rose to prominence in the 90s as teenagers, and in one year they went over to take on the likes of Tony Hawk and the might of the American skateboarding team, and ended up finishing first and second in the 1996 championship. Yeah.
They're seriously good skaters on a global stage.
Almost instantaneously, too. I mean, that's kind of how dedicated they were to skating. And then where the documentary really becomes interesting is the inevitable fall from grace. And this feels a little bit like a Greek tragedy as skateboarding doco.
Okay, let's have a little listen to the trailer.
Had these huge dreams. Gone to America. Got a smash Hulk.
Oh, my God!
Who are these guys?
They were powerhouses. They just killed all the contests.
The best in the world right now.
They became impossible to deal with.
Right there was when it started to go sour.
Next thing you know, we hear doom doom on my roof, and it's a beer bottle with a sock on fire and a full of petrol.
We did things to let him know you can leave now.
Me and Ben realized right then and there who we're up against.
Right, so there's drugs, there's death, there's a whole lot of terrible things that happen. What's this documentary like?
This is pretty impressive. I think the best sporting documentaries are those that don't just focus on the sport or don't just sort of fall back on the underdog tale.
Yeah.
And that's in there a bit, particularly with the US-Australian rivalry. And, I mean, in fact, the Pappas brothers both sort of adopt the position of the underdogs. And quite rightly, I mean, they've gone over there as teenagers with nothing, with just a desire to kind of beat the Yanks. Interestingly, Tony Hawks, who, from memory, when I was into skateboarding for those 2 years in grade 5 and 6, he was, you know, the name in Australia. He was the name of skateboarding. He comes off in this documentary a little bit like Lance Armstrong, as maniacal, win-at-all-costs, collude with sort of ESPN and the X Games to have the Aussie boys who are threatening his throne booted out of the country.
Yeah, I think he aspires to sort of Kelly Slater-like status and doesn't quite get there. That's my understanding of it.
Well, I mean, and part of that is because he's the good, you know, good guy next door, all-American hero, and you have these two brash, and they are pretty brash, Australian brothers who are, in every sense of the word, volatile. And where this documentary really becomes interesting is the fall from grace, is the fall into drugs, the spiral out of control. We see one of the brothers gets arrested for cocaine possession on his way back from the States, which sort of ruins his chances of ever going back and competing. And as you heard there in the trailer, he says that's the moment where it all started going sour. So it is, it has a kind of epic weight in terms of the tragedy. But what I found really interesting about this documentary, and most of it is told through talking heads, both ones that are for the brothers and those that are against, is that the older brother, Tuss Pappas, who spent time in jail, is a really conflicted character. And it's an uneasy relationship with the audience that the filmmaker constructs, because he's not particularly likable. I mean, there's a moment early on in the film where there's footage, and there's so much archival footage in this film, where they're sitting in a car and they're watching these two other kids on a vertical ramp. And the kids are doing that thing which I can remember doing, where they just stare at the top.
And they don't want to do it.
And they don't want to do it. And you hear them abuse these kids. And this one kid kind of goes down, comes up, and he's like, that's terrible. And, you know, they were the bullies of the rink. So it constructs an uneasy relationship. But what is fascinating is the way in which you see, the torment that this guy goes through and his attempts, and maybe he doesn't kind of achieve it, but remorse and reflecting on his life and the kind of tragedy that's really befallen these two brothers. But also it's interesting just from a historical period, because there's so much video footage. And that's the thing.
I was going to ask, so there is a lot of footage from the 90s that they have found.
80s from Northcote to St.
Right.
Albans to
Wow.
the skate parks in Paran. And that's
because
they
were always keen adapters of, I remember actually watching skaters in the late 80s and early 90s with really big clunky video cameras, you know, filming themselves.
And that seems to be one of the interesting parts about skateboarding as a kind of countercultural or lifestyle, is the way in which the videoing and the video technology was sort of part and parcel of that lifestyle. I mean, it was, you learn tricks, but they had to be shot on video. And then, you know, these videos would get passed around and dubbed. So I found that interesting. So there's other levels at which this sort of documentary works on beyond the the personal. And you even have one character, one of the American characters, talk about, you know, skating used to be so good, but then it got sold out by corporate interests. Now it sucks, man. So, yeah. Okay. But this is only on limited release at Cinema Nova. But I think it's definitely a worthwhile documentary. And if you compare it to some of the best sporting documentary series like the ESPN 30 for 30,
yes,
this really stands up there with some of the better ones.
Good as Crash Reel?
Different to Crash Reel, but yeah, it's got the same sort of interesting subject. And, you know, the fact that it doesn't give you an easy relationship with the protagonist of the documentary is sort of fascinating.
Okay. Look, because of that and the out-of-control nature of these two brothers, out-of-control characters. Now, you've already been tweeting in and texting in. I'm so pleased that someone mentioned this one because... is he my favourite out-of-control character? Yeah, I think he is, actually. Javier Bardem, who is... I'm not sure how to say the surname, but Anton Chigurh. We mentioned him a lot, but it is really a stunning performance. In No Country for Old Men, the Coen brothers film, based on the Cormac McCarthy book that I've read, four times. Have a little listen to Javier Bardem's, one of his best roles.
What's the most you ever lost on a coin toss?
Sir?
The most you ever lost. The coin toss.
I don't know. I couldn't say.
Call it.
Call it.
Yes.
For what?
Just call it.
Ooh, gives me shivers every time. And I think we only played that little bit of audio about 4 weeks ago. And someone else texting in, Walter from The Big Lebowski. That's from Tim in Ocean Grove. Is it John Goodman who plays Walter?
It is.
I think we've got a little bit of, when isn't he good? But anyway, here's John Goodman as Walter in The Big Lebowski. Oh, no, look, we don't have.
We could act out. What's that great line? He says, I don't roll on Shabbos.
I don't roll on Shabbos. No, I am not going to act out anything from a Coen Brothers film. Interestingly, we've had two Coen Brothers films. But look, 0437-774-774, your most powerful out-of-control film character. Someone else saying that Brad Pitt in California, viciously out of control. I don't remember it. Michael Douglas in Falling Down. Is he out of control?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's out of control. I think that fits into the
defends.
Boundaries. Totally. Look, I'll get to your calls as well. 1300-222-774.
On 774 ABC Melbourne, you're listening to Raphael Epstein.
Josh Nelson is here talking film with me. We're talking about out-of-control characters off the back of...
All This Mayhem.
Thank you. All This Mayhem, the documentary about the skaters. Let's keep going with your calls about out-of-control characters. I'm enjoying your texts. Mr. Pink from Reservoir Dogs. That's...
Buscemi?
It is Steve Buscemi. Thank you. Couldn't get the name into my head. Johnny Depp as Raoul Duke in Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. Well, I think that's the definition. If you look up out-of-control in literature or film, you see Fear and Loathing, no? Someone else naming Glenn Close in Fatal Attraction for being out of control. Okay, yes, I like it. Joe Pesci in Goodfellas. I think he's in the dictionary as well. Have you got a nomination before?
Anything with Joe Pesci.
Oh, anything with Joe Pesci.
De Niro in The Untouchables and with the baseball bat scene.
Absolutely. Team. I want to talk about Team. Grizzly. David's call from Eltham. Hi, David.
Hi there. How you doing?
Good. What did you want to tell us?
Look, earlier this year I saw a documentary on SBS about two Scottish guys who were rappers and couldn't get a gig. And eventually one of them found an agent in London with a Californian accent and immediately got booked. So they travelled down to London in character and for the best part of 3 or 4 years convinced everybody that they were from California.
Right, and they're from Glasgow.
And they're from Glasgow.
Right.
And, of course, it was great. Their music was great and they were trying to put the record out and the guy's delaying it because, you know, as soon as it's out there, they're going to be stumbled. They wanted to take them to the US.
Right.
Of course, they feigned illness because they couldn't get a passport. They knew it was going to be up. It's called Phil and Bill, I think.
Bill.
Syllable. Okay. Syllable. Look it up. It is just fantastic. It takes, they did this for years. And there's, like, okay. One guy got married and he had to convince his girlfriend that he had to maintain this American character.
Well, I give him full marks for maintaining the elements of the practical joke. Fantastic. I'll get to more of your texts on out-of-control characters, and you can tell us as well. 1300-222-774 is the phone number. But let's talk about the Rolf de Heer film. Now, Patricia Karvelis, who I've been receiving lots of fan mail for. People loved hearing from her last week, and a big thank you to her for filling in. She spoke to Rolf De Heer, and just have a listen to the director of Charlie's Country speaking about when he went to meet David Gulpilil at the film's conception.
So I saw him in jail, and I asked him at the end of the first meeting that I had with him, first hour, I said, David, what are you going to do when you get out? Mm. And nothing, nothing. I said, well, what do you want to do? He said, I'll make more films. He said, no, I want to make another film with you because that one that we did, and he was talking about The Tracker, that's the best one I ever did. Mm. And I understood that he wanted to make something meaningful. Because he also has lots of cowboy films and that sort of stuff in his head.
Yeah.
But he wanted to make something meaningful and something personal in a way. And so that's how we did it. I'd go back to the hotel room and write, come back, 23 hours later, and we'd do the process again.
So that's Rolf De Heer, the director of Charlie's Country that stars David Gulpilil. Tell us briefly what it is and what you thought.
So this is the third collaboration, and this is very much a collaboration, as you just heard, between Gulpilil and De Heer. Gulpilil plays Charlie, a man living in a remote community that's under the intervention. And, the film is really about his struggle to find some sort of meaning in his existence, any kind of meaningful existence, which ties back into the kind of the personal content and, I guess, the kind of origins and the genesis of this film. And we see him sort of struggle in a kind of day-to-day life. And the film plays a lot on repetition, a lot on, what some of the issues without kind of beating you over the head with it. This is not a kind of a documentary in the kind of the John Pilger style of a way in which it approaches Indigenous Australians. But what I found really fascinating and why I think this is a truly remarkable film, and I only saw it today, is the structure. And if you think about the structure of most films, particularly most mainstream films, the protagonist drives the action of the narrative and imposes him or herself on the events of the narrative and really determines the outcome. And particularly, you heard there this idea of the cowboy and the Western figure. It always comes down to the actions of the hero to determine the how the social landscape is kind of reconfigured at the end of the film. What I find fascinating about this is the way De Heer has a character who has no control over anything. And every time he attempts to do something else with his life, whether it's on a small scale like going hunting or trying to go bush and reconceive his own lifestyle, the outside world intervenes, and the outside world here is the kind of the white police force. And so the film is really a series of kind of repetitions in this struggle to find something that he can control and something that he can grasp as his own, and trying to reconcile the two worlds in which he lives. And this is an idea that I think De Heer's been playing with in other films, and we have to mention it because no one else has so far. Even in Bad Boy Bubby, you have a character who's reconciling himself to two worlds.
Yeah.
And even the Richard Dreyfuss film, The Old Man Who Read Love Stories, where you have a character who exists on the kind of the boundaries and the outskirts of these two worlds. And this is what this film does really well. It plays on this idea of a character who exists in two worlds that aren't reconcilable, really, and how do you create a sense of meaning? How can you exist on the fringes of two worlds? And so as far as an Australian film goes, I've heard this called an art film. I think that's a little bit misleading because I don't think it's sort of out there. I think it's actually quite an easy, approachable film. I think it's a truly remarkable thing, but mostly it comes down to Gulpilil's performance If you're going to have a protagonist where there's not a lot of action and a lot of it's stasis and silence and a kind of a character trying to kind of, exist in the world, then it really comes down, or the success of the film rests on his performance. And, there's a saying that directors often like to use about certain actors that, he or she gives good close-up.
Okay.
David Gulpilil gives good amazing close-up. Yeah. His eyes say so much.
It sounds actually like a direct depiction. The biggest problem for the powerless Indigenous people in this country is that they lack complete control of their lives, and this sounds like a perfect depiction of that.
Without emphasizing the political, it's not a film that's so didactic that it has to say, this is happening. It's a lot of that stuff is in the background, but it plays on our political issues through the personal character. So it's a way of trying to understand these issues, perhaps without the kind of the magic bullet solution. I don't think the film's trying to offer a solution, but try to get us to understand it through this Charlie character. And the fact that he's an elder as well is a really important issue. And the film builds quite nicely and goes places that I didn't expect it to go.
So actually, we've got a unified theme here: lack of control and out of control, and in fact, even perhaps the the brothers in the skateboarding film completely buffeted around by forces beyond their beyond their power as well. That is called Charlie's Country. Is that on wider release than
You'll see it limited release, so outside of the multiplexes, but most of the sort of Palace, Nova, etc.
Okay, and on the Out of Control theme, Catherine's called from Malvern. Hey, Catherine.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Any of the characters in Train Spotting was with either lack of control with respect to drug taking, but Begbie specifically.
Yeah, he's getting a lot of takes on Begbie.
Completely out of control as a person.
100% couldn't agree more. Beautiful. A beautiful way to end. And
That scene where Robert Carlyle throws the glass over his shoulder and then runs downstairs, and I can't actually repeat what he says when he gets down to the bar.
Horrific. Absolutely horrific. And someone else mentioning Jack Nicholson, The Shining, which is and someone else mentioning John Cleese in Fawlty Towers. And you know what? It's not a film, but bang, you fit the bracket. Thanks so much, Josh.
Pleasure.
Josh Nelson, you can see his work at filmology.com.